Thanks for tuning in to the Medevac Podcast, powered by the Robert Irvine Foundation, whose mission is to support and strengthen the physical and mental well-being of our nation's heroes and their families. I'm one of your hosts, David Reed.
And I'm your other host, Christian Myers. Thank you very much for joining us today on the Medevac Podcast. If you're new here, there's a price for the show. You have to share it with a friend or family member if you get something out of today's episode. We've got a pretty cool guest today, so I think you're going to learn something new. I've already learned something new. Our guest is Rob Youngkins. He is a former Marine. I always get in trouble saying that.
Yeah, that's fine. Former's good.
Previous Marine. Still a Marine. He was an FO in the Marine Corps and then a MARSOC JTAC. So we're here to talk to him about his time in service, what he's doing now, and why we have a fancy little background today here in Florida.
A little bit of a special episode.
Yeah.
Special couple of episodes coming your guys' way. We're doing a Reunite the Brave with the Robert Irvine Foundation, where we're doing essentially a reunion of the 1st Raider Battalion, right? So welcome to the show, Rob.
Hey,
appreciate you for being here.
Chris.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, let's kick it off with why you joined the Marines. Like, what was it? Was it family, duty?
As a judge.
Judge.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, it's not that sexy. So my father was in the Navy. My grandfather was in the Army. My other grandfather was in the Army in World War II. I guess that kind of was the undertones, but I really didn't have any aspirations to join the military myself.
Okay.
It helps that I went to a Army JROTC high school from 6th grade to 12th grade. I was in LaSalle Institute, upstate New York. So we wore uniforms. There was drill and stuff like that. I didn't really care about that.
Was this a voluntary thing or your parents made you go or?
Well, I went there to play football
because
my little central school and farm town, upstate New York. We didn't have enough insurance, turns out, to put on a football team. So I went there and academics were good. It was good school. My mother worked a couple jobs, basically raised by a single mom. Anyways, went over there, smaller school, 90 kids in our graduating class and a couple of my knucklehead buddies.
Just a little small.
Yeah. It's fairly small, right? I guess these days. A couple of clowns, Josh and Mike, got me to join. So they got me on the buddy program with them joining the Marines as enlisted men. Both of them bailed out. And then a week after we graduate, I'm in boot camp in Paris Island. Wondering what the fuck. Are we cursing?
Oh yeah.
You know what?
Totally good.
Rules are off the table today.
Okay. So wondering what the hell I had just gotten myself into. You know, I'm up for a challenge and I knew college was not happening.
Yeah.
We couldn't afford it and I hated school.
Sure.
So, that makes sense.
Needed something more.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you decided to be an infantryman because of your friends.
Yeah.
And you got stuck with it. Okay.
Wisdom does not come easy at 17.
Sure. You know? Yeah, absolutely.
True story. True story. Yeah. Go ahead.
I knew I'd worked on a farm all throughout my teenage years. And I didn't have any problem with hard work, especially not physical work.
Okay.
So I figured what's the worst that could happen? Plus, I don't know how it was in the Army or the Air Force, but they waved like a $5,000 joining bonus in my face. And I was like, yeah, I want that job.
Yeah absolutely.
That's a lot of money. That's worth.
Worth infantry. It always brings me back to Starship Troopers. Good for driving the infantry. He's got no limbs.
Exactly. You made the right decision.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So how quick did you find yourself after enlisting going off to boot camp?
So it was August 2002 that I signed up. So about a year after 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow. So that I'm sure that had to do with a big impact on your decision to join the Marines,
especially in New York.
I think there were definitely tones of that. I didn't have any conscious thought of hey, it's my responsibility. It was we're at war now.
Yeah.
That's the thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And again, school is just lame.
Sure.
Yeah.
I get it.
So what did that look like for you? I mean, you went through training and were you deployed pretty quick?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So May 2003, I ship out. Boot camp, SOI, and then job school for being a forward observer and naval gunfire spotter. And by December 2003, I'm in San Diego reporting into Camp Pendleton, my first unit. 8 months later, I was heading over with the 11th MU to Fallujah. Well, first we did the Battle of Najaf in 2004. Smaller battle, but it was the Muqtada militia. So we hit the deck. In Iraq, you know, when you hit Iraq, it's like a you step off the plane, it's like a fucking blow dryer in your face.
Yes, it is.
Right?
It just smells like carbon. Yeah. This hot air.
Get that shock.
Yeah.
And I went, a couple C-130 and Hilo flights, and I'm in Najaf. Would you get dropped into the battle there? Give us an OP. We start getting shot up, and I'm just boot as shit. In fact, when we did get back to the base to get some R&R, we were next to the cooler where they were keeping bodies, right? Mm. And then the reefer went down on the cooler. So it stinks to high heaven. There's flies like I've never seen in my freaking life.
Yeah.
But it's 100 degrees at night, and I've got a poncho over me to keep the flies off. So there's no freaking sleep.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah. Oh, man. And what year is this again?
It's 04.
Oh,
that was
so
August 04.
Nothing. Yeah, there's nothing over there at this point.
Yeah.
And that's got to be quite a wake-up call as well.
Yep.
Yeah, you're thrown to the wolves pretty much right away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then we Fallujah 1 had happened, right? So those contractors got hung on the bridge, those Blackwater dudes. And so they were gearing up. This was about 6 months later than that. And they started planning this major operation to clear Fallujah called Operation Phantom Fury. And for the JTAC geeks out there, it was the invention of keyhole CAS, where we had a whole city, whole urban operation going on, multiple units. They're deconflicting airspace at the highest echelon, but really they're keeping it simple. It's north-south or east-west, and they're doing it by time deconflicting. So it was huge for in the world of fires and JTACery, however nerdy that may sound.
JTACery, I like JTACery. Can you dive into a little bit of the Navy gunner spotter? Like what that training entailed and what the activation of that looks like?
Yeah. So your typical FO going into the Marine Corps is artillery and mortars. I think your audience probably knows that. And then for Marine forward observers, we also qualify for naval gunfire spotting. So you're a scout observer, and really it's limited to direct fire, essentially. And it's coming off of no more battleships, but we're talking off of destroyers, cruisers, their guns, directing them on target, and just, ship to shore communications, HF, UHF. So you have to be a good communicator, and you have to have the ability to. That's when you really start, because being a JTAC or a forward observer, you have to have a 3D view of the battle space and really be tight with maps and grid locations. We know how important that is for medevacs as well as for calling in fires.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Is that something that you ever enacted in combat?
Naval guns?
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
No.
That would be awesome.
In OIF-1, they had the Alpha Peninsula. They called in some naval gunfire there, but I wasn't a part of that one.
Yeah.
Have you got to, in a training environment, call in, and that's got to be, how does that feel?
It's good. You can typically see the ship, and you see a puff of smoke, and flash to bang.
And you're like, that was me.
Whomp. Yeah.
That's good. That's a kind of question, too, it might be a little off the wall, but how does that count? The camaraderie behind it, if you're the naval, gunner spotter, you get the confirmed on the boat. Are they trying to take the credit for that, or who gets the credit? Yeah.
They're just a voice on the radio, to be honest with you.
Because
I never actually got to see those dudes.
Yeah.
It's not like Artie or Mortars.
Yeah,
sure.
But I'm sure that's about the most exciting thing that happens to those squids on ship.
Yeah, I'm sure.
That's funny.
Yeah, that's an interesting job position. I don't think we have anyone on the show that has been in that job.
Now we have. Yeah.
Now we have.
So you make it through that that first deployment. How long was the overall deployment for that first one?
One was more like 6 months.
Okay. So standard rotation times for the most part.
Yeah, our captain got blown up. Pat Eldridge, what's up, sir? He got him and our radio operator with the SEALs, he got hit with an RPG. The SEALs did a great job with some combat trauma. Really, before all that was formalized, those dudes were on it. They got him patched up, got him medevaced. And he went back through Landstuhl. I don't know if I want to reveal exactly what happened, but this area got sliced open, thigh and then groin. And that's all he wanted to know about is my Johnson okay?
Oh yeah.
Common question.
That's the first thing after any explosion.
Yep.
Yeah.
So he got medevaced, and then, so that was in the middle of the Battle of Fallujah. So we just found our way with like Kilo 3-1 first platoon. And we had a couple months where we were just sitting there like helping out the Force Recon platoon on some raids, but we didn't have a captain. We didn't have a team leader. And there was only, it was a 5-man team that we deployed as. So, yeah, that one ended in January 2005.
Okay.
Came back.
2005.
And then yeah. I'm imagining you're spinning up for another deployment soon after that.
Yeah. This was such a high op tempo in those days. I think you guys were both in that same time, right?
Yes. So
before we got back, we knew we were going back over in August 05, back to Iraq. So we are, so we just went straight in, had some fun post-deployment leave, and then straight into workups. And then, yeah, August 05, I'm back out the door, go back out to the Al Anbar province in Western Iraq, where the Marine, you know, area of operations was.
Okay.
Was with Second Force Reconnaissance attached to those guys again. This was a 4-man team, and we're doing fires and JTAC type stuff for them. 150 point target raids all over Al Anbar. We were in Operation Steel Curtain up in Husseiba on the Syrian border. A couple of medevacs in there. And, you know, I guess if we tell the whole story, like you'll come to find every deployment, if you're the JTAC guy, at least back in those days, the docs weren't really in charge of calling in medevacs. I mean, the nine line's not that hard, but because it involved typically air CASAVAC, it would be on the JTAC or the fires team to call those in. So we were always ready to go and we were calling those in. That deployment, we didn't take a ton of casualties. We did lose Seamus Davy from the platoon there. But my third deployment was August 06 to March 07. And I ran 65 medevacs out of the city of Hit, Iraq.
Okay. Wow.
That's a lot.
Yeah. So it was just coming and, you know, anywhere from routine, these freaking dental operation to urgent surgicals.
Sure.
So yeah, well versed in the needs for LZ marking and, you know, calling those fellas in.
Yeah. So you're one of the few who stuck around for that ops tempo. Most of the guys who were going like year after year after year,
yeah,
I feel like they got out pretty quickly, but you stuck around and went for, what would you say, four total deployments as an FO?
In Iraq, yeah.
In the span of 5 years?
Yeah. So. I mean, yeah, by 2008, I was coming back from my fourth deployment. So that was March 08 to October 08. And then the next month I was over in MSAB training up for an Afghan deployment.
Wow.
I didn't really know, you know, you can look back at it and say, you were down with the op tempo. I was like, this is just life.
Yeah,
like, it's,
absolutely.
Yeah. It's just my life.
It's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm. And deployed life starts to make more sense than at home life.
Yeah. The structure is really nice, right?
Yeah.
Did you have no family at the time, right? Going in.
No, I couldn't hold down a girlfriend. Like, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it's an interesting topic because at the end of the day, your focus is 50%. If it's family overseas, this is distractions. So, you know, focusing on the career at first, I'm sure was helpful.
Yeah. I mean, I guess in retrospect, beer was there for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? That's a common one too. Yeah. You know, stuff it down with brown.
Yep.
So that ops tempo was pretty extreme. So you're in Afghanistan. Talk about kind of like the differences that you felt between Iraq and Afghanistan. It's pretty substantial.
Yeah. I mean, obviously there's obvious stuff like the languages are different just for simple commands. You know, we're not really interpreter or anything, but and the climates were similar because where we deployed in Afghanistan, it was southwest. It was Farah province and Helmand province. Mm-hmm. So, you know, right there by Iran, it's very, very similar to Iraq, but the differences were, you know, kind of the culture. Like Iraq, we had just toppled their government and there was a people without really a structure. Come to find out once I got to Afghanistan, the Taliban never really left.
Yeah.
They were always the shadow government. Mm-hmm. And if you asked anybody when I was there, 2009 to 2011, who do you pay taxes to? Oh, it's Taliban. Like, they take care of our, if the water line's broken, they're going to take care of it. Mm. Like, so that was it. Like, there was some quasi buy into democracy in Iraq, but Afghan, they couldn't care less.
Terrain, big terrain difference too.
Terrain for sure.
So I'm sure that comes into play with, you know, all your operations too.
It does. You know, for JTAC or for a CASAVAC aircraft, high, hot and heavy and humid are the enemies for yes. Lyft. So 60s did okay in Afghan. In Iraq, you could get by with, you know, 53s or 46s on the Marine side, CH-53s, CH-46s. That's really not as much of an option in Afghanistan because of the altitude.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was mostly 60s for us in Afghan.
Sure. Mm-hmm. That's where I flew out of in Afghanistan was Helmand Province as well.
Oh, at a bastion?
Yeah, at a bastion. Yeah. Okay. Camp Leatherneck out there.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, good times out there. So you wrap up your fourth deployment as an FO in Afghanistan. And then
fourth was Iraq.
Iraq, okay.
And then I cross-decked and went to Afghanistan. So that's when
okay.
With this weekend we're here for Alpha Company. So that's when I joined late 08, okay. Went over to 1st MSOB, got assigned to Alpha Company, and I became their JTAC and started workups for Afghanistan right away. Mm-hmm. And then June 2009, we deployed for Farah Province, Afghanistan.
Okay. What was that transition like into the special operations community from the conventional side? Is there, you know, is there a training element where they try to wash you out? Is there anything along those lines, or were you accepted pretty quickly?
No, accepted right away. Okay. I had a good reputation. What we would do in Anglico, my first unit, as Air Naval Gunfire Liaison Company, we take 4 or 5 man teams, and we do all the fires, all the communications that you need. So basically, you take that, you boil it down into one man. Mm-hmm. And as a MARSOC JTAC, I'm a one-man show. I have to be self-reliant in everything. So everything sure. that 4 or 5 men are doing, obviously, you have help. You have teammates to, you know, fill radios with crypto and stuff. Mm-hmm. But that was the biggest thing. I didn't mind it. I liked the independence. I never really delegated well to my Marines anyways. One job done right, you do it yourself. But I'd say that's the biggest thing. And then the quality of the people around you. Mm. I don't know. I'm guessing Rangers, right, Dave?
Yes.
Very selective, and you can get kicked out, right? And in regular Fleet Marine Corps, you can't just get rid of a dude. Like, no. It takes a mountain of paperwork. Even if he's a shitbag, you can't just kick him off the unit. In MARSOC, this is – you're gone. One negligent discharge at the range – you're fucking history.
Yeah.
Wow. So that, the standard.
Okay.
And the fact that everybody's an independent operator on the team, the sum of all parts was greater than its components.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's a much different concept, the way the Marine Corps went about it, you know, vice the Army, the Air Force, or the Navy.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you're just kind of accepted in, but it sounds like, you know, it's a volunteer force, right? This is you have to want to be in that unit, and you have to prove yourself pretty much every day.
Yeah.
If you say no, you don't volunteer, right? And you're gone.
Yeah.
So can you, like, before the show, you kind of hit on a little bit of the history of this, you know, special operations coming into the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
They were a little late to the game, huh?
I don't know if these guys, the other fellows are going to talk about it, but, 1986, don't quote me on that, but I think it was 86, the U.S. SOCOM, Special Operations Command, was, I guess, a charter by Congress, chartered. And they started with representatives from all the branches except the Marines. Mm-hmm. Our ego, our pride was like, every Marine a rifleman is our little motto. And they were saying, we're all special. We don't need to participate in Special Operations Command. So for the first 20 years, there was no Marine representation. As Afghanistan and Iraq started kicking off in the early 2000s, we started kind of sobering up, like, hey, we're missing out on some of this, as a force. And so they started Det 1. I remember on the West Coast, I don't know what the East Coast equivalent was. I was West Coast my whole time out of Camp Pendleton. Det 1 was kind of the precursor to 1st Marine Special Operations Battalion, which was the West Coast representation of MARSOC. That was all hand selected. So what was the natural pool to draw from for our unit really, was Special Operations Training Group, which we had some training dudes, some salty old dudes, but even those guys came from the, 1st Recon Battalion, and 1st Force Reconnaissance Company. So Recon, Force Recon, similar, but Force Recon is a little bit more specialized. It carries some heavier equipment around. But either way, that reconnaissance tradition lived strong throughout the early MARSOC tradition. Mm-hmm. And being on the West Coast, because really, you know, Marines are simple. We're not like you guys. We have bases fucking everywhere. We got like two bases, and then we got Okinawa. So West Coast, we were always thought of as like the Hollywood Marines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then East Coast was like really regimented, wearing your fucking web belt, you know, trousers pressed.
Yeah, high and tight near the flagpole kind of thing.
8-point top.
We're wearing flip-flops out there on the West Coast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And so what was it? It all started out of First Force Reconnaissance Company's CP, their command post, in Las Flores area of Camp Pendleton. And that had a rich tradition back through Vietnam. There was all kinds of tiger pelts on the walls, you know, memorabilia from all their conflicts. And so we started out of there, which was just a little concrete shack. They pulled in a couple fucking trailers and they're like, hey guys, you know, you're going to go fight the Muj in Afghanistan. Here's some trailers to operate out of. So it was kind of grassroots, but
okay.
I don't want to spend all the time that you guys have talking about that, but to put it in the big picture, for 20 years, we had been hoping to get a taste of Charlie Sheen, you know, Navy SEALs, yes, or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But the Marine Corps was stifling us. We finally got that opportunity. It was drawn from an already tight recon community and tradition. And it was a bunch of rabble rousers. It was just a bunch of salty dudes who knew their way around a gunfight. And there was already a cohesion in place. So we kind of started with that identity. And that's why it's important for Alpha Company to get together this weekend, is because we had tight bonds.
Yeah.
And because we pioneered Marine Special Operations, it was something new. Mm. And we all, there are a couple guys here who have plank holder certificates, which is, you know, you're the start of a new unit, but all of us really got MARSOC off the ground with our operational, our deployments over the next several years. I think that's what makes us so tight to this day is the bond of starting something new, being that alone and unafraid, pioneers. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. And I know we can stray from the topic after this, but I'm curious, what is the actual purpose of MARSOC? Is it beyond force recon, like Navy SEALs, for instance, UDT, yep, underwater demolition, Green Berets, unconventional warfare, right? Everyone's kind of got, sure, their specialties. Is this an advanced version of reconnaissance or just more along the operational line?
It's a great question, brother.
Yeah.
We didn't have that fully nailed down,
yeah,
when it kicked off. We found that through bumping into the other components of, sure, special operations and finding a place within the theater of war we were operating in at the time.
Yeah. Natural evolution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So who owns direct action? Delta Force, sure, NSW, you know, the SEALs. We did some of that, but that couldn't be our thing because it was their thing. And at the time, SF, Special Forces for the Army, they were known for human intelligence. And so they had that on lockdown.
Sure.
So at least as I recall it, and what, you know, some senior dudes in the day explained to me, what were we going to specialize in? It was more signals intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And working with the technology to get intel. But of course we were still
especially
First Force, right? So, yeah, they were used to, you know, packing out some equipment, some high speed, low drag type stuff. So that fit naturally.
Okay.
But we also took on mission sets, direct action, foreign internal defense, FID, partnering with the, Afghans partner forces,
yeah,
and training those guys up. So my seventh deployment was a commando mission, and we were in and out of the Helmand Valley, you know, everything up to the Kajaki Dam.
Yeah.
We were in there for anywhere from one period of darkness to like a week or two, okay, setting up a village stability operation. So a wide array, I guess. Yeah. There's no
jack of all trades.
Yeah.
Oh, it's very interesting. And I never spent too much time with the MARSOC guys, few and far between, you know?
Yeah.
So I never got a chance to like actually understand what their mission set was, but
yeah,
it makes total sense. And the natural evolution as well too. I mean, Green Berets started as UW, but they haven't really done that in the last, you know, 10, 15 years, at least, yeah, in the
And what's available, what missions are available.
Exactly,
right. Fall in on whatever you can.
So, yeah, mm-hmm, that makes total sense.
You know, there was a certain amount of like, yeah, we're going to take these guys and rebuild this bridge. Like,
yeah,
I don't know what the hell I'm doing.
Just, yeah,
tell me what to do.
Yeah. Where can I be useful?
You spent a long while. So you did three deployments in Afghanistan?
three, yeah.
And four in Iraq.
Yes.
So that's quite the range of seeing, like, especially like in the beginning, since 9/11, like getting deployed pretty quick to Iraq. What was that transformation like over the courses of your deployment? So what I mean by that is, you know, as far as like based establishments go, grows, there was huge growth. Like, we're starting to open up restaurants on bases. Oh. Like, what does that look like when in the beginning to like towards the end?
Well, we knew if we went to an Army or Air Force base that you'd have better like coffee shops or something, right?
Yeah. Green bean. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, you start in tents and all of a sudden you have full operational bases.
Man. Dude. Yeah, you're right. It's more just a distraction. If you start to go to the coffee shop too much and yeah, you know, like later deployments, there were more like girls around, that kind of thing. All my units for the whole time I was in were all male. So that's always a welcome sight, is you know, pretty girl once in a while. The buildup, was just continuous. And I saw it throughout my time in Iraq. They're pouring that funding in. We know nowadays that it was a lot of money washing hands, Halliburton, KBR.
Yes, all Halliburton. You can say it. It's okay.
Okay,
we know now. Yeah. There's movies about it. It's not a secret. Right.
Dick Cheney. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that, that was obviously not in my, I was not cognizant of that at the time. I just knew by my first deployment, it was like, maybe the AC in your tent breaks. What the hell are you going to do? Well, we'll start hot wiring it or whatever the hell we can do.
Yeah.
Maybe we find an Afghan who can
figure it out.
Yeah. And then on the fourth deployment, I was back in Fallujah, actually. It was peaceful, or, you know, less hot, obviously, than the first one. But then we're calling the KBR guy. Mm-hmm. If something goes out, like, oh, yeah, come put in a work order.
Yeah.
And the KBR guy will come fix it. So,
yeah, big transformation. And two, I always like to hit on, like, the armor. You know, in the beginning.
Yeah.
Right. It's, you go from sandbags to up armor.
God.
You know?
Yeah. Soft top Humvees with sandbags on the side.
Yeah. And everything's like BDU and like, there's, you know, an unnecessary amount of like having your protective mask on you at all times, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
And on the bottom, right? So Humvees, flat bottom, we know that's bad now. We didn't know it at the time. Like, what about IEDs? Yeah, we'll just lay some Kevlar blankets under our feet.
Yeah,
that'll work. And we'll bolt just this steel on here. Yeah,
it'd be shatter all right. Shatter all your bones.
Yeah, everything.
So I don't want to take a tangent, but
take a tangent. That's this whole point. Yeah. A tangent.
So a lot of your guys that come on the show are going to be veterans, right? And they're familiar with the claims process. Back in the day, when you're deployed, you're probably not reporting all the bumps and bruises that you got into. So to your point about armor, my second deployment, we're all over Al-Anbar, like ground mounted, very few helo ops at the time. And we would go 12 to 16 hours at the longest to go do a hit in the middle of freaking nowhere. So we're off-roading, a lot of times driving at night. Where do you put the FO? Where do I have the best odds?
On the job.
Up in the gun. So what is a gun turret on a Humvee in fucking 2005 in Iraq? It is a circular hole in the roof, right? With a tiny little platform to stand on. Really nothing to keep you in there. Except they weld it on like a semicircle of high ass fucking steel, right? Mm-hmm. On the back. So you could at least have some cover on your back as you're returning fire. And I'm up there with like a 240. We would off-road so freaking much. And you know what part of a Humvee flies around the most when you're off-roading in unexpected bumps? It's the top. So I'm getting tossed around up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I got my stupid flak on and all this shit.
You're just a pinball.
And the pinel hook for the gun, it won't stay in there. So I'm trying to keep the gun in there, hold security, you know, for whatever's in this stupid wadi over here. There's nobody over there, but I have to maintain security posture. And I'm not strapped into anything. There's no padding. There's no nothing. So one of the things, I can't substantiate it, but one of the worst things I've got is I've got like everywhere that a sappy plate would outline on your back, just from getting wailed against the back of the turret, off-roading for hours on end, just getting slammed. Like my mid-back is fucking toast.
Yeah.
I would imagine. So yeah, no medevac, but probably should have.
I mean, that's so that has given you back problems.
Yeah.
That's specifically, I mean, being beaten around like a pinball is no fun on those things. Metal on metal too.
Yeah. No kidding. I mean, it's like being in a washing machine with your flak on.
Yeah. Yeah.
forever. Yeah. Or maybe a dryer rather.
so unfortunate because like, you know, most people are like, yeah, finally we get to do a ground assault force or whatever. And I'll be in a vehicle. And then, you know, then you just get tossed around.
But yeah. But you don't gripe about it at the time. You just kind of suck it up.
And think
about it.
Yeah. Just embrace it. Yeah. You can't complain about it. Everyone else is enduring it at the same time.
Yeah.
So you transition. We'll go back a little bit. You transition into special operations. Yep. What was your experience like on the deployment in special operations? Obviously, it's a little bit more cleaned up. You have access to better equipment, I imagine.
Bigger planes.
Yeah.
Air support, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We, 2009, we went to Shawan, which was a Taliban stronghold off the 517 in Farah. And I was on team one. Team two was over at Delaram. Team three was out of Fab Radia. Either way, we went into Shawan. It was like a football field size cutout of HESCO barriers.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing.
Yep.
So we just parked our vehicles in there. We started building our own little fire base. Better equipment, but we were also, again, just kind of getting started. We didn't really have much to fall in on.
Sure.
And so that one was a little bit more austere at the beginning. Built that one up. By the time I got to my sixth deployment, I didn't really say it, but I was on a stupid desk job up in Bagram.
Oh,
okay.
At the Siege of Sotif,
working
the fires desk up there. I felt like I was marginally helpful getting air to everybody, all the JTACs that needed it in country, but again, it's a desk job. Got in trouble with the Special Forces Sergeant Major, for throwing weights in the gym, whatever.
You were throwing weights in the gym.
I was just the rubber weights, it was like CrossFit workout.
Yeah.
And he didn't like that I was dropping the weights on the, that's what they're, anyways.
So he put you on the desk?
Yeah.
He put you on the desk for that?
No, I was deployed to be on one of his desks.
Gotcha.
But, man.
Territorial pissings. And then my seventh deployment was much more choice digs, right? So we were on Leatherneck.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember, there was a little Afghan out, the Afghan side of the base was called Shorbach.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a special, we had a special operations compound called Camp Antonik, after Chris Antonik, one of our fallen. And we were operating with the commandos out of there. So a FID mission. We had three companies of commandos, and we would just go all up and down aerial inserts, up and down the Helmand Valley.
Okay.
But when we were at home, when we were on base, not that often, but when we were back there, great gym.
Mm-hmm.
I won't name any names, but we had a fire water retention facility just in case the barracks ever, caught fire. We would have plenty of water on hand to put it out. Not that dudes weren't, sunbathing in there or anything.
Yeah.
That would be completely out of bounds.
fire water retention facility. Yeah.
So yeah, it's a range of niceness, and more being built up, throughout my experience at least.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't show up there to 2013. So it was fully built by the time I arrived there.
But, yep.
That's quite a difference, especially when you're out operating at places like Delaram or Wolverine, like you were mentioning, like it's just a couple of HESCO barriers vice, fully built out compound.
Yeah. But I don't know. I like that side of it, a little more Wild West. You were kind of a desperado out there.
Yeah.
When you're just in a little fire base or really just making a security circle with your buddies in the vehicles. Yeah.
All right. So, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you did quite a bit of deployments and when we often have conversations with guys where when they do multiple deployments, it becomes real for them, right? The first couple maybe, seems like Call of Duty until they lose someone, something like that, right?
Okay.
So like what was that like for you where you were like, I'm in the shit now. Like this is real life. And like I said, is you get that kind of flip where it's not cool anymore. It's like, why are we doing this?
Yeah. take away the second part where I ask, why are we doing this? Because I was a boot, right? So that first deployment, I got thrown right into the fire. Mm-hmm. Najaf was a pretty big battle. There's a historian named Dick Camp who actually wrote books on both the Battle of Najaf and the Battle of Fallujah. Recommend anybody check it out. He does a good job of documenting both battles. But, you know, these were like post-Ba'ath Party being removed. These were the clerics who were vying for power. And then Fallujah, you guys know the story there, mm-hmm. right? But Najaf, that first night, we get the briefing. I don't know what the hell the captain's talking about with the lieutenant colonel. We were supporting the army in that one, 2-7 Cav. And then the next day, we're inserting into this OP in like the only five-story fucking building in Najaf, right? So there's us, there's some snipers, there's some SEAL dudes up there. Shit, sorry. And we're getting schwacked because we're the biggest fucking target out there. So I learned what, that whack of rounds going over you sounds like. I learned what it means when it hits the wall behind you.
Yeah.
We got shelled a couple times, mortars, RPG started. So it was real right off the bat. It wasn't really. And then Fallujah, if you never, have you guys ever talked to a Fallujah?
We have.
Yeah. Okay.
We have.
So, I mean, I can feel it. I can see it like it's happening right now. We're waiting to completely clear the city. The mine clearing guys, the engineers are blowing that up. We got AC-130 overhead, just thumping 105s at every vehicle lining the streets. It was like that was like a movie experience.
Yeah.
But there was no choice but for it to be real. Mm-hmm. Because the next 2-3 weeks was battle. It was like block to block. There was some downtime where you get to, you know, take a dump in the alley or something, but that was about it. Yeah.
So it got real for you pretty quickly.
Yeah, for me.
Okay. Yeah. Usually it's one or two deployments in. People that we're talking to, at least, they're like, yeah, it was kind of glorious and I enjoyed doing it until my third deployment. I'm like, why the hell are we here? This doesn't make sense to me anymore. But I can appreciate that. You went right into the shit right away.
It's good, but that ignorance is bliss only takes you so far because I was giving so much of myself in retrospect now. It was foolish, some of the stuff we were doing. But at the time, I thought it was necessary. I thought it was the highest purpose
for me.
And you're a dumb boot. Like, what do you, you don't really.
And they instill that in you in the Marine Corps. I mean, that is just ingrained into your soul at that point.
Yeah. So 2012 is when you depart the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
Under what circumstances was this? You were just ops tempoed out, or did you want to pursue something else?
I'll condense it. We had a commanding officer at the time who was nobody's favorite. Mm-hmm. He'll probably be a general soon, but that's beside the point.
No surprise.
Yep. So no names, but as I just outlined to you guys over many minutes, I had a long, hard first 8 years with an extension in there. It was 8.5. Mm-hmm. And I'm deployed on that 7th deployment, this commando mission where we're like gone, like 20 days out of the month. We're operating in the Helmand Valley.
Yeah.
I know I'm EASing in December and we're slated to come home November.
Okay.
So I'm like starting, you know, I have to email back and to the rear and can I just get an extension? Give me 6 months because you guys have been pumping us full of this. They call it redlining, right? You can't have this many deployments in this amount of time.
Yeah.
Here's how it works. When you come back from a combat deployment, you need 60 days to adjust and maybe you'll be used to this. And then you need 3 months or 6 months to adjust to this. Just give me 6 months, man. This is what you've been putting down our throats. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't do it. Didn't want to give me any extension. The reason I was clear about it, I was like, I don't know if I want to reenlist and I don't want to make this decision. Well, I'm sitting here on my 7th freaking deployment in 7 years, pretty much. And they wouldn't do it. So I ended up getting a bargain of a 3-month extension. So I got out in March, 2012, but there's just that experience where, you know, that was kind of more of a light bulb moment where it was, I am just another cog.
Yep.
In your head, you tell yourself that story, like the unit will never be the same if it's not for me, right? If it doesn't have Rob, I have to protect my fellows and do the job, but nobody else can do what I do. Mm-hmm. Well, then I'm more just a cog in the wheel, just a number for these guys, manpower wise. And I, I was either facing reenlist and rotate back to the regular Marine Corps, which I could not go back to that after working with these dudes.
Yes.
Or get out. And, you know, that was actually the harder choice at the time because I was, in retrospect, institutionalized. And, you know, striking it out on your own was the hard thing to do. So I said, F it. I had a buddy who I grew up with, Billy, who has a business experience in New York City. And I had this vision to start my own food truck, which I did.
Okay.
Nice. What did you serve?
So it was called Confirmed Grill. It was a healthier food
Confirmed
truck.
Confirmed Grill. That's clever.
Yeah.
Like it.
Grill 'em All was taken, believe it or not. But
Grill 'em All.
So Confirmed Grill. Actually, some of the fallen that you guys probably saw at the memorial today, like Dan Price, Charlie Cartwright, it was healthy wraps and salads. And I named them all after, kind of like the Carnegie Deli, named them all after some of the fallen that I knew around the Camp Pendleton area. And we were going to go out to ranges because I don't know how it is on you guys' ranges, but you either bring MREs, shit food, you know, snacks from the chow hall or from the PX, or you just wait for the chow hall later. Like that was it. Mm-hmm. There was also this like roach coach, what we call it.
Oh yeah.
Disgusting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The burrito truck with the blue tops.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh man. Yeah.
Terrible food. And we're supposed to be these specimens, right? Especially like special operations dude. No, we're eating fucking roach coach food. So I was going to rove out to the ranges and just serve guys, you know, when they're out there training, some actual healthy food, wraps, salads, that kind of thing.
Brilliant idea.
And I think people would have loved it. I was hiring spouses and dependents only. Nice. And we were all set to go. We were finalists for a contract on base to have a commissary, a restaurant to operate out of. And then in 2013, sequestration happened. Yeah. You remember that? Mm-hmm. They pulled all the funding for all the new MCCS contracts. And I was not prepared to operate out in town with the health department and all this civilian regulation. So I just went contracting instead. Yeah. As soon as I got out, while I was starting that business, I was slinging pizzas for Domino's. So just knocking on people's doors like an 18-year-old. Yeah.
Yeah. Grinding, putting your time in. Yeah.
Whatever. Pays the bills.
Yeah. Well,
you know, and you have to, and that's what a lot of people miss or don't consider when they're getting out is like, my paycheck is not guaranteed. My health insurance is not guaranteed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like it's all on me now.
And all those bills that are associated with it too. It's like, you know, That's a big thing about the military is they do well at taking care of you while you're in. You know, you're not dealing with food or electric or, you know, all that stuff. You have your amenities, and then you just get hit by that. So I'm sure that was a big transition.
Yeah. I had bought my own house, thankfully. Okay. So I had that locked down. Starting a business, like there is no income. Yeah. So the VA was pretty good to me because I put in a claim. That's one thing they did tell you in the time for transition. There was no skill bridge or anything that they have now, but they were like, "Yo, start your VA claim before you get out." And at least I got healthcare covered by that. Yeah. And I didn't have any dependents. So
okay.
I was a free agent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Made it a little bit easier to just focus on yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the food truck didn't work out. And then you said you started contracting.
Yeah. Between, I was instructing JTACs out of our schoolhouse in Coronado, California, which is freaking gorgeous.
Yeah, absolutely.
And while I was doing that, I got an offer for a job out in Hawaii, a Marine Corps base out there. That's a yes.
Mm-hmm.
Sold my house in California, bought a house in Hawaii, was loving it there, brought my girlfriend at the time out there. We ended up getting married. Not the best decision. You know, what are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
She joined the Army later and we started going all over creation. I don't know. Went to San Antonio, Seattle, and then finally Colorado, Colorado Springs. We split up. And so then I'm a free agent again. And then I started the business in 2019, 2018, started the investing software, Terasori.
Yeah.
My business supporting that. And then 2021 started eFoils. Yeah. So the entrepreneurial spirit never really died. Just kind of I paired up with somebody that just wasn't going to work out with.
Sure.
And that suppressed my dreams. Plus contracting is, you know, military light.
Yeah.
There's no growth. I don't think, I don't want to put a blanket statement out there, but if you just do the paramilitary thing, I don't think you really grow.
It's not for flag either. So it's like, it's different, you know,
it's for money.
Yeah. It's for money.
Yeah. It's trade.
I understand that perspective. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So yeah, business has always been something you were interested in, and now that's what you're doing full time.
Yeah, not so much. Sure. You don't get rich, yeah. You know, training people on e-foils or doing
that's
technical
more
support.
For you.
But it's yeah. passion.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, there's a meaning behind it.
Yeah,
and I'm sure. And before you dive into this too, I'm sure that this e-foiling too is a big part of it. A component is that laser focus ability. It's like a therapy for you, mm-hmm. correct?
It is therapeutic.
Yeah.
It's meditative. Hopefully, you guys will get out there tomorrow on the boards. But it's once you get up off the water, it's silent. It's completely yeah. silent. And yes, you have to be present, focused in the moment. But you can just you can daydream while you're out there, mm-hmm. and you can think about whatever problems are facing you. But it's also just fresh air in your face, and yeah, e-foiling is very meditative. So it's meaningful in that way. It's a skill that can infinitely get better at.
Mm.
Shit. You can, there's no ceiling on e-foil skills, right? So you can experiment as much as you want. You can customize your board, and you meet cool people.
Yeah.
Is another cool thing. The networking side of business, I didn't really think about it at the time with the food truck, my first go at it. The people you meet mm-hmm. and the relationships you create, that's where the meaning comes from. And then really what I did was cognizant of in every business was the autonomy, starting your own business. I told you about that experience with Colonel, the CEO who was not so great.
Colonel so-and-so.
Yeah. What's his nuts? Fucking Joe bag of donuts. I just knew in my bones that I wanted to do my own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you're not really cognizant of your dreams, but you know, my current passion is farming, starting a homestead. I got a little family now, my girl and three kids, and we're going to start a homestead and become food independent.
That's amazing.
And yeah, you know, calling your own shots.
Yeah.
There's a lot of responsibility to that, but mm-hmm. the reward is worth every second. So if anybody out there is thinking about starting a business in order to achieve sovereignty in their own life, autonomy, highly recommend it. Don't go any other way.
Mm. That's beautifully put. I like that. That is, that's a good path. And I think it probably was instilled in you post service. You're like, I'm not serving anyone else after this, right?
Yeah. Well, we all had bad commanders and platoon sergeants and stuff like that. So you get a taste of what that is. And you know that that's stifling and suffocating.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, some people don't really want the full responsibility and they're happy to just punch the clock and go for it. That if that's what you aspire to, there's nothing wrong with that. No judgment. But if you want that freedom, mm-hmm. yeah, it's well worth going out there. It's uncertain. As you guys know, you started the podcast, right? Like you didn't know what it was going to be. And but through your own force of will,
mm-hmm.
you can make it into what you want. And you'll know intuitively if you're in with the right people and if you're going in the right direction.
Yeah.
And if authenticity, what I get from both of you guys since I met you a couple of days ago is you're authentic. And, you know, even through this interview, like you're asking me questions because you actually care and you want to put good out there. So appreciate you.
Thank you for the nice compliment. Anything else about my eyes? Maybe my hair.
Your fantastic hair.
Don't stop there.
So, in kind of closing, I just want to talk about what we're doing here this weekend, like what it means for you and kind of how you got connected as well as started diving into your own network to make some of this weekend possible.
Yeah. Well, you guys know the Robert Irvine Foundation well, and we are very grateful for their sponsorship and putting on this event. It might not have happened without that because funds was a big concern.
Sure.
But I mentioned my girl who I'm with now and just never been this in love. We met last year at a funeral for one of my old teammates, John Wayne. And you know, she and I had known each other back in the day. She was actually a Gold Star widow.
Okay.
So one of her guys was one of the names, Charlie Cartwright, that we celebrated this morning at the memorial.
Mm.
And you know, that what does a woman go through? She's broken, right?
Yeah.
Had some tough times and we lost touch over those years, but then Wayner unfortunately hung himself, John Wayne. And we reconnected at his funeral last year. Well, the next, and that was March 31st, we started dating, 2023. The next week, she was going to a 1-5 reunion, like a battalion-wide thing.
Okay.
On Camp Pendleton that the Irvine Foundation had sponsored. Mm-hmm. So that's where it kind of entered.
She went to 1-5. We were there. We were there for that one at Pendleton and did, yes.
Yeah.
So that's
giant hike, like a thousand people or something.
It was amazing.
Yeah. We did First Sergeant Hill.
Yeah.
Yeah. You did. Yeah.
Yeah. And we, Christian and my other Ranger buddy, we ran it. We had to beat the Marines. So,
of course.
Yeah.
Dumb grunts.
Yeah. But that's interesting. Yeah. It's small world, but yeah, she was at 1-5 reunion.
Right. Because Charlie, was in 1-5 and my girl's name is Marissa. So that was like a week after Wayner's funeral. And at that same time in parallel tracks, Tommy, who you'll talk to, Keith, and a couple other guys were just texting like, we can't have the only time that we see each other be at a funeral anymore. And it's happening too often. So that's when the seed was planted of getting our own reunion together because we had such a tight community I was telling you about, through those first handful of years. And so how did this come together? It was the merging was because of Charlie Williams, who you guys know is just a bad motherfucker, salt of the earth, probably sacrifices himself a little bit too much for the cause. But of course we appreciate everything he's done. There was another 1-5 stay platoon snipers reunion in October in Patriot Point, Maryland, which you guys know. So we went there. That was just the snipers. So it was a smaller thing than the big 1-5 deal. Met Charlie Williams out there. And at the time it was like, he's like, you know, what are you up to? I'm like, well, we're trying to get this reunion back together. And so enter the facilitator there who, you know, he's the master of getting it all together, with our intent to get back together in a peaceful circumstance and create new memories. That's when Charlie was able to facilitate getting us together this weekend. We did all the planning kind of by committee.
Sure.
Hellman Valley Gun Club party planning committee, got together once a week or every other week. And we just figured out the logistics. E-foils factored into that because
beautiful. You know, that was perfect. Well placed.
Yeah.
You knew a guy.
Yeah. Knew a guy. And I knew how transformative it was for me. So I'm glad everybody got their chance. And hopefully we can do this every year and the guys get out there and hopefully pick up the skills. There was something I wanted to say about the suicides, right?
Please.
So I mentioned I'm on the board of a nonprofit now. It's the Raider Realty Foundation. And our purpose is pretty simple. Provide housing for Gold Star and White Star families. And a lot of folks, maybe even in your podcast, haven't heard of White Star. It's suicide, right?
Yeah.
So those left behind by somebody like John Wayne who commits suicide, get them housing. Because typically when that happens, whether it's a catastrophic, you know, combat kill, or it's a suicide, it's abrupt and it shakes people's lives up because now a lot of times that main income provider is not around anymore.
Yeah, of course.
And you have to pick up the pieces. So housing shouldn't be an issue there. We have a lot of ideas and we're getting off the ground. We're hopefully providing our first house this year. But if you want to support Raider Realty Foundation, please do. I know we don't have too much more time, but I do think it's worth talking about this epidemic of suicide. And I've been there. I was on the bridge a couple of years ago. Mm. My buddy Sam, who you guys will meet later, ended up being the one I called, you know, and I was pretty close. What saved me was my dog and Sam, of course. I'm going to give him too much credit. But it was like I drove to the bridge with my dog in the truck and like what's going to happen to dude, my dog, if I do jump? Mm. So that kind of brought me back. What I think, and you guys were over there in the same theaters, having seen the Dick Cheney movie about Halliburton, knowing that we just pulled out like it was a whim to pull out of Afghanistan and that debacle in fucking Kabul airport.
Yeah.
Charlie Cartwright died. Fucking Chris Antonick died. All these dudes, Josh Meadows, for what now? Mm. And I think that's weighing heavy on a lot of the guys, special operators. Yeah, we're supposed to have this steely mind, right? And fucking, you know, elite, I guess, mindset. But no, when you yank somebody's purpose or what they had attached their purpose to for so long, I think that's tied to it. I know it was a factor, at least in my suicidal ideations. I don't know if other guys if that's on a conscious level for everybody else. I know it was for me.
I think the conscious level, not for everybody, but two, subconsciously, like you're saying, is transitioning from your beginning deployment. You even said it during the show, is you like felt that purpose, felt that drive, felt that mission. You knew that this was the most important thing in the world. And you felt like that good guy. As the years progressed, you know, especially during the exit, we no longer felt like the good guys anymore.
Yeah.
And how does that feel when you're still got the uniform on? So it's two conflicting values, essentially.
Yeah.
And that does weigh heavy, especially you're just like, what's it for? What's the purpose? What am I doing?
Yeah.
So you question yourself and the flag, you know, at the end of the day. That's tough.
If it was all just a money grab and the forever war, military industrial complex thing, shame on those motherfuckers, first of all, for
shame.
Playing chess or checkers, at least with our lives.
Yeah.
For what, you know, and that's a big question too, is, you know, we've shifted to this kind of individualistic perspective of like, let's take care of the person. Mm-hmm. Now.
Yeah.
And, I think that we're being much better than that. And that's why the veteran community is so pertinent.
Yeah.
Is to like be a driving force to make changes. And we're doing that now by making a message and like, you know, doing things like that and raising awareness, talking on this podcast and saying enough's enough. That's how it's supposed to make change.
Yeah.
And that's why we do things like this, because it's not, we know that they're not going to take responsibility for us anymore and it's on us. And there's no not doing it. If
you're right.
We know what the outcome is if we refuse to do it ourselves. So we have to accept our licks now and move forward. And this is the best way to do that, in my opinion, at least. It's our responsibility. Let's do what we can to, you know, bring the guys back together.
With an eye to the future, I think, is the key. Because if we wallow in the self-pity of having been wrong, let's say, or gotten it wrong, at least, of supporting some war in the Middle East that really had nothing to do with my mom back home in upstate New York.
Yeah.
Buying into that was a brainwashing, a trap, right? But it was a ready laid trap. The force that concerned me in retrospect now, obviously, thank you for your service. How many times you heard that, right? And it's much appreciated that you would appreciate, but I feel hollow inside for what I did in the past. Mm. What would be more useful is what has been organized here and what the veteran community does to take care of itself. It's a bridge to the future. Because why was I on that bridge? I didn't feel like I had a future. I had isolated myself from all my teammates.
Yep.
I didn't have that community, that tribe.
Sure.
And what unites us in unity of purpose is the future. What can we do together? There's so many bright dudes here in Alpha Company and our teams. We don't need anybody else to start badass businesses together. Like I'd love to see going forward inter-networking or intra-networking of the team. Guys are entrepreneurial and these are some of the most capable dudes and minds out there roaming the earth. There's no reason we can't form an even stronger network going forward. Not just business, but you know, just socially and in community sense.
Sure.
And I think that's what's important to take away is that it's about building something from here forward. Doesn't matter what happened in the past that bonded us, but now what we do from here forward is going to carry us out through our actions.
And match those values as well, right? And I think selfless service, you know, is a huge part of why people join the military. And that's so ingrained in them to be a part of something much larger than themselves. So finding something, you know, a community of those like-minded individuals is going to make the greatest change. And we talk about this all the time in business as well, is those values, those ethos that are brought to the veteran, you know, from the military community, that's what's going to push this country to the next level.
Yeah.
So we appreciate you for coming on today and sharing your story. Is there any kind of like last minute things you'd like to say? Or
2011, we're all up and down the Helmand Valley. Thank you guys for bringing litters to kick out to us on the ones we put our casualties on your birds on with, because a lot of times we would end up needing them the next day or that same day. So thank you for that. Rangers, you know, you guys aren't good for much, but you know,
I always tell people I guarded bears. Yeah. Like, what's a ranger?
Park ranger.
Prevent forest fires.
That's right.
Well, thank you, Rob, for coming on and sharing. It was awesome chatting with you.
Yeah. Thank you guys.
Real pleasure. This has been the Medevac Podcast, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for watching today. If you're interested in learning more, you can head to medevacpodcast.com or head over to social media. Follow us there at Medevac Podcast. That's MEDEVAC. It's spelled on the thing you're listening on right now. So just type that in. Head over and follow. You can reach myself and Dave directly there. If you want to get in touch, let us know what types of topics you want to talk about or...